You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week in episode 644, reviewing everything and anything. The Beatles versus the Stones, part 900. James Blake saves the music industry. Speech fasting. And hooray for James Blunt. That's all coming up after The Small Faces and Song of a Baker.
There's wheat in the field and water in the stream. And salt in the mine and an aching in me. I can't go no longer.
Wonderful band who underwent the most delicious transformation from Kings of the Mods to a sort of urban psychedelia, I suppose. Four fabulous musicians, Kenny Jones, Ian McLagan, Ronnie Lane, Steve Marriott. I remember this album particularly standing out in the record store racks when it was released because it was packaged in a circular cover, which is very unusual, and it was mimicking a tobacco tin. The album was number one on the album charts here in the UK in the summer of 1968 from Ogden's Nut Gone Flake, The Small Faces and Song of a Baker.
An excellent song from an excellent album. I listened to that recently and very much enjoyed it. So, it's one of those sort of touchstone albums that, isn't it funny how best album lists or kind of, particularly music publications' best albums list, quite often there are some albums that always end up near the top, aren't there? But there are other albums whose fortunes tend to wax and wane depending upon what's going on at the time. And that Small Faces record, I remember it appearing quite high up in places like Q and NME during the sort of the mid to late 90s. I think that the Britpop resurgence reminded people that and the Kinks, Village Green Appreciation Society, that I think records like that had a sort of a resurgence then. But I suspect probably wouldn't appear on those lists so highly now because they're out of fashion again. But a shame because it's a cracking album.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. Welcome along to Parish Council episode 644. I'm Terence Dackham, and this week, Russell Cook, nicknamed Hard Geezer, completed his run of the full length of Africa.
He did, the hardest geezer, as I believe he's known. Yes, quite.
What's she done this week? Let's ask Juliet Harris.
I've eaten some Chris Terrence. What more do you want? Yes, that is that was a rather leading question. But your judgmentalism is as always quite justified. As an elderly relative of mine would say, I've not been well, and then that shuts down any kind of conversation.
Yeah, that kills that one stone dead.
I've been here, I've been there, I've won quizzes,
you've been in Oxford, haven't you?
I have been in lovely Oxford, seeing our friend the Headington Shark. It's all been going on, Seti. I did not run there and back, sadly, thus making me only the second hardest woman in St. Leonard's. Hello, everybody.
Well, we're about 10 minutes in now, and what I want to know from everyone is, so far, are you satisfied, slightly satisfied, strongly satisfied, or are you strongly dissatisfied? We were in a bizarre and incredibly irritating age where we're asked to review everything. And this came to my mind last Thursday. I booked online a table in an Italian restaurant in Virginia Water.
Yeah.
And I immediately received a reservation confirmation. Then I received an email confirming the seating. As if that was different. I mean, I was anticipating being given a seat, but there we are.
You're fine. Yeah, then, I mean, one would hope that would be included in the price.
I kind of presumed it would be part of the deal.
Unless it's like a Ryanair-style restaurant.
Oh,
where
yeah,
you
of course.
To, like,
you have to pay extra to sit down. Yeah. Yes, yes. Then after we sat down, ping with my phone, another email, thank you for dining with us. So I logged onto their Wi-Fi. An email, thanks for joining our complimentary Wi-Fi. The next day, please rate your dining experience. It's also exhausting. I mean, another example. I recently sold a property, my mother and father's house. They weren't living in it. They both passed on, I should stress.
I mean, that's very generous of you.
Mum, Dad, I've sold the house.
Is that otherwise, yes.
Now, sold their property. And the conveyancing lawyers, they were absolutely relentless in asking me to review the experience. I've got phone calls, emails, WhatsApp. And in the end, I refused to review them at all because I was so peed off with their persistence. And I mean, just final example. Last week, I bought a cheap and cheerful storage rack for the loft. You know, really cheap and cheerful thing. Next day from Wix. Tell us about your recent Wix purchase. Click on a rating below. Jules, I'll tell you what I want to tell them all. My feedback is two words, but I'll just say it as leave me alone is my feedback.
Yes, thank you very much. That's something off indeed. Yes, I do agree with you. So it is quite irritating. Although if you are going to hassle people for a review, I'd also went to an Italian restaurant recently, dined in a restaurant, and in a very nice restaurant in Notting Hill. And we were looked after by a very cheery lady called Michaela. And they are clearly, you know, young, sort of, you know, upwardly mobile Italian waiters, all competing with each other for business. She came up to us and said, could we leave a review on Google Reviews? And if we were to do so there and then, and she gave us a card with her name on it, she would give us both a free shot of limoncello, which we were very happy to do. So actually, if you want people to give you feedback, bribe them with drink seems to be the answer to that. Yes, I agree with you. It is irritating having to review things all the time. Although I can give you the frustrating thing is when you do give feedback, people don't seem to care about that feedback. So my mum recently, regular listeners will be familiar with the heroic figure that is my mother. She recently had a run-in with a website, I won't name, over some azaleas that she bought. So let me give you her review and their response. So she said, your website offered a rainbow collection, quote unquote, of azaleas, pack of three for $19.99. I mean, that seems steep to me, but it's today's economy. They do have a lovely garden. So, and it rains. Rainbow azaleas, what's not to love about that? It refers to the picture above, so I believed it to be reasonable to expect three similar plants. The colour scent are very disappointing. See photos. White is not a rainbow colour. Goodness me, that's very deep, isn't it? And the other two are very similar. I feel I've been missold and that the offer is very misleading. I should like some advice from you as to how to put it right. I'm a carer looking after my 83-year-old husband, so what might be hard to best sort out? By the way, my dad is happy to be used as a weapon at various points in time. And so the response comes, dear Diane, good afternoon. Thank you for sending the photos of your rainbow azalea japonica collection. And I apologise for any confusion or disappointment caused. I mean, that to me is live confusion and disappointment anyway. These plants are as we would expect them to be upon arrival to you and should, with the correct care and planting conditions, continue to thrive and grow. The photos of the website, on the website, of the three colours that closely match your photos. They change the photos on their website, said Terence. Between my mum's complaint and them receiving it, and my mum's reply, said, which I would very much enjoy. Thank you for your email. If you read my email again, you might notice that I never complained about the quality of the azaleas sent. They seem fine and healthy. My issue is with the misleading colour change. I hopefully have attached two photos. Who knows if she has or not. She claims to have done. One of those advertised are not those received. I cannot see how you regard them as closely matched. Clearly, you have no intention of taking any notice of this complaint. I don't know why I expected any different. My review would disappoint you, brackets, if you actually care, that is, close brackets. I will share my experience with the gardening club and others. In the meantime, you had better go to Specsavers. Regards, Diana Harris.
Oh,
and
Lord.
The thing is, she's right. If you leave a stinking review, who cares? A local tax to me, I will name and shame them actually, because I hate them. 24/7 taxes, who are not so much 24/7 as 9/5 from what I can kind of gather in terms of that. I have defected to the excellent New Car Miles instead, who have an app that actually works. So you book through the 24/7 app, and then they go, and then you ring them up and go, "Where's my taxi?" And they go, "It'll be half an hour, love." And so, but I call enraged local people. What they did was they bought up every local taxi firm, and then COVID happened and they lost all their drivers and then they couldn't cope. Like all enraged local residents, I've taken to Trustpilot to complain. And every time anybody puts a negative review on Trustpilot, they have given auto reply saying, "Oh, we believe that most of the reviews we get are fake." Beware of reviews. So I have a friend that's a copywriter for a living, and one thing she taught me was you should never ever believe any reviews of anything you read online, because she was paid by various appliance manufacturers to write fake reviews, essentially, to be put onto websites. And sometimes when you get things advertised on Facebook, like, you know, "Oh, this new wonderful mop has changed my life," and all the comments underneath go, "Yes, I use this in my kitchen," some of those may not in fact be real. They may be people that have been paid to put those things. So actually, when it comes to reviews, it's very much a racketeer industry, City, and it's you know, it's annoying enough being asked to leave a review. You can't rely on them either, it turns out. And does anybody listen? Will my mum get justice for her japonicas? Probably not.
Well, it's a very distressing story. And I feel, you know, very sorry for your mother.
She's right. Why? I mean, she does make her sound slightly racist. White is not a rainbow colour, still.
Well, she's right. I mean, this is always the thing, though, as you say, that, you know, who really cares? Because at the end of the day, that her review will drop down and more reviews will come in place.
Yes, and unless, of course, anybody else has had issues with their Japan.
Well, of course.
But they've changed the photos, so nobody will.
There we are. No, indeed. Indeed. No, I mean, it won't be long before judges have to ask convicted felons, you know, "What did you think of my sentencing today?
Yes, how was my driving when I sentenced you 3.5 years for ABH?" Yes.
Yes, quite. Oh, it's just an irritating trait of modern life. It really is.
It is, particularly when it pops up when you're still like having your meal at the time, or the car wash are often needy for validation. My local car wash, I must say.
I was watching footage of the Beatles via YouTube this week. I often do this. It was a film of their performance at the New Musical Express Poll Winners Concert in 1964, and there they all were in their suits and ties, all bonhomie and joy, Ringo grinning, Paul beaming, cheery in between song chatter. And this was the way they were portrayed, I mean, through Brian Epstein and the press, TV and radio. They all fell in with that. And their entire story between 1963 and 66 was construed, constructed, really, I suppose, around, you know, that premise. But meanwhile, the Stones, still dressed decently, like office clerks, but not, portrayed, I suppose, through Andrew Luke Oldham as much as the Beatles of Brian Epstein, dressed decently, but they were sort of portrayed as the bad boys, dangerous, not too dangerous, but the opposite side of the coin to the Beatles. And the Stones were photographed in shadows, in urban environments, gave sarcastic and drawled answers to the media. And I mean, I think this was too was maintained, has been maintained, perhaps still is to a degree, to make them appear to be the sort of outlaws of pop or rock. And so what I'm wondering, Jules, is as someone who has experienced both groups decades later and after this period, you know, and after the Summer of Love, Psychedelia breakup in terms of the Beatles and the Stones, Pop Bad Boys, Altamont, Brian Jones, Mick Taylor, Ronnie Wood, endless tours, general decline in interest, it has to be said. Do you see the Beatles and the Stones through the polarised lenses I do of the 1960s, or, and that's the same as many of my vintage, or do you view them completely differently as you sort of became aware of them only in what would have been, what, the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, there's an interesting question. I think that it's a trope that the media has tried to use with various bands down the years, trying to persuade the public that one band is quote-unquote good, and therefore there has to be a sort of a counterpoint to them, particularly in the manufactured pop industry as well. So neither the Beatles nor the Stones were manufactured pop, but it made me think of... take that and their rise in the 90s. And then you had E17 that was seen as the kind of edgier boy band that came from East London.
That's so true, yeah.
And also, I've been reading the excellent book Reach for the Stars recently by Michael Cragg, which is about his view is, and it's very compelling actually, it's a very readable book if you're interested in this sort of thing. It's about his thesis is that the 90s and the noughties was the last great era of pop. So it starts with the Spice Girls forming and it ends with in the sort of the various X Factor things. But it's a very interesting book and it talks about the formation of the boy band Five, which were always styled with a number five and then the letters IVE afterwards, means technically we have to call them Five Eyes. But anyway, the boy band that was Five Eyes were deliberately manufactured to be a harder edged boy band to rub up against people like Westlife and the sort of slightly cleaner cut boy bands. I think the thing about the Beatles and the Stones is, I guess at the time, as you say, they tried to make the Stones out to be edgier. I guess their music is kind of bluesier and perhaps a bit grubbier than the Beatles' music. Having said that, though, they were still pretty tame by comparison, weren't they? And I think that when you see what came afterwards with people like the Sex Pistols and the Clash, who were genuinely pretty... the Sex Pistols, for all that we've talked about issues with them on the podcast previously and how they tended towards the pantomime, they did end up saying the F word on TV, didn't they? Which, compared to the Stones, I think was perhaps a bit edgier than that. And the same my era, sort of Oasis and Blur were my era as Beatles and Rolling Stones. And again, Blur were, I think, sort of portrayed as being a bit better behaved than Oasis, who really were portrayed as thugs, rightly or wrongly, I think. There's always been a bit of a class issue, I think, as well. Although, interestingly, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, the Rolling Stones were more art school, weren't they, than the Beatles, who were genuinely quite working class. Yet it was the Stones that were sort of the badder people and the Beatles that were slightly more clean cut. So it's interesting to think about it from a class dimension, I suppose. I suppose my generation just knew the Beatles and the Rolling Stones as really, really good bands, and you either preferred one or the other. And I think that you know, obviously, I love the Beatles. I'm probably more the Beatles than the Stones, but I've come to appreciate the Stones more as I've got older, actually, I would say. But yeah, I don't... Like you say, that I think there's always, you can trace all the way through pop, these kind of ideas that there always has to be goodies and baddies. But whether or not that actually gets traction in reality, I don't really know.
Yes, I think it made it all the more telling, you know, when I think parents' reaction in the 1960s, say anybody over 35, 40, when the Beatles admitted to taking drugs, it was, oh my goodness, front page of the Daily Express, and parents who previously thought, oh, lovable mop tops, suddenly sort of went against the Beatles. And similarly, in a perverse way, when the Rolling Stones were interviewed and they were pleasant or came up with some sort of, you know, intellectual point of view, particularly after... again, in their court cases and Rees-Mogg's father writing the editorial in the Times, you know, who breaks a butterfly on a wheel.
What a strange evolution that's turned out to be.
Yeah, very much so, I know. I'm still expecting Jacob Rees-Mogg's eldest boy to be in Parliament soon. This is
almost probably. Well, there are various children, aren't they, with various... Oh, yes. One of Jacob Rees-Mogg's relations, by the way, is genuinely called Somerset to Chair. There's some very strange things going on in that family. other. How ironic that usually you expect generations become more liberal, the children and the grandchildren. Yeah, compared to that rather liberal editorial. Not travelling in a more liberal direction, shall we say.
This is very true. Coming right up, the unravelling of Hypnosis. And this week, James Blake saves the music business. That's next up to Jamie N. Commons.
One look, twice so, three fall away. She looks at me, held up, let down. She sings me silent melodies, hair whip, tight lip. I feel calling out for you. Tell me no truths, they're just all of your lies. Don't you tell me no truths, I want all of your lies. Oh, well, well, so give me all of your lies. 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 Do the rumble this week.
Rather fun song that I discovered. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine I was dining with last week, and she'd written some quiz questions, which inevitably she tried out on me and I enjoyed very much. And she had some questions about music that had been featured in Levi's adverts in the 90s, which had reminded me how much I'd enjoyed them. And I looked to see if there were any playlists on Spotify. And the thing I love about Spotify is someone's always made a playlist for you already.
One step ahead, yeah.
Yes, indeed. And someone had kindly made it. There were a couple of ones, but there was a very long one about Levi's adverts. Turns out this had been used in a Levi's advert in 2014, which I hadn't quite realised. This is a great song. I really enjoyed it. The title track of the EP, that song's called Rumble and Sway. It's by Jamie Commons, who's Jamie N. Commons, but his full name is James Nicholas Commons, so that's where that came from. But anyway, and that's been used in various things, apparently. It's been used in the trailer for Hail Caesar, the Coen Brothers film. It was used in season 3 of Teen Wolf, an American drama, and in Suits as well. And I can see why that gets used on soundtracks. That's got a bounciness to it that I really enjoy.
I thought it's absolutely wonderful. I hadn't come across Jamie before, and I'm certainly going to listen to more from him. It was really great stuff, I thought that.
Yeah, absolutely. And he seems to have had a number of things. He did some work with ex-ambassadors and did a tune that was in Orange is the New Black, a trailer for that. Mm. It was in a video game. It's been in the film Pitch Perfect 2. There are certain people that seem to be quite talented at writing for films and adverts, and he seems to be one of them.
Now, A year or so ago, we discussed the Brave New World, in which a music royalty company gives heritage artists literally millions and millions of dollars. And that royalty company, in this case Hipgnosis, makes millions and millions and millions of dollars by leasing out that music, which that they now own, to huge corporate businesses who then increase their sales by using the Beach Boys to sell mobile phones and Bob Dylan's soundtracks, a commercial for Airbnb and so on. It's all based on the long tail theory that by purchasing these music catalogues, Hipgnosis take the view that these songs are long-term predictable assets that are unaffected by economic cycles. Indeed. If anything, it was expected that the music could only grow in value by these people. So everybody wins. Mike Love, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Chrissie Hynde, dozens more can relax on the beaches of Malibu while we all go and buy cell phones and book up Airbnb. Except, Jules, it isn't quite turning out that way.
No, it is not, actually. So it's all gone a little bit wrong at Hipgnosis, although we found ourselves in the unusual position of covering a rolling news story, which is not usually what we set to do still on a podcast, not least because the whole point of a podcast is that you pre-record it. But anyway, between us deciding to this and us doing this, the story has evolved, as they say. But it's never good when as a company, I feel that things were not going well. If there was a news story about my company in which the word troubled featured in the opening sentence of the story. It's not going great, is it? Hipgnosis Songs Fund, the troubled publicly traded music royalty company, issued a damning report compiled by a third party, this is on March 28th, that details missteps. Again, not a sentence one wants in an opening paragraph about your company, the fund, and its investment advisor made, leading to a 26% portfolio downgrade earlier this month. It became, this is a billboard article. It's so beautifully written. Every sentence is a gem. The London-listed fund, which became the poster child for music as an investable asset class, basically has told investors not to... not to expect the resumption of dividends for the foreseeable future. They're busy paying down debts there. There's a fantastic, the name of the Hipgnosis founder and music manager, the incredibly named Merck Mercuriadis. I mean, what a name that is. Apparently, materially overstated their revenue. Basically, it turns out there may be monies in them there, Neil Young fields and hills, but not as much as one thought they were. It seems very, it seems like, it's almost like things might not, it's almost like you need someone independent to say what your stuff is worth, isn't it? It's almost like people may say their stuff's worth a lot because they may have a vested interest. I don't know why this has suddenly come as such a revelation to people anyway. But everyone knew they were overpaying. They were paying. If you pay the top price of something, you'll end up going bust eventually. Now, having said this, since this excellent Billboard article, The Guardian reports today that the Hipgnosis has agreed a takeover by Concord Chorus. All of these are just, they sound made up, these names. Yeah. They don't sound real, but this is real. Has apparently agreed to a takeover by a rival. I'm not so sure this is so much a hostile takeover as a help us, we're drowning takeover. They still paid £1.1 billion for this. It does seem like, so this is on the FTSE 250 Hipgnosis. And the idea is that its investment model is that, as well as, you know, owning the back catalogue to people like Shakira, or to give her a full name, Shakira, Barry Manilow, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blondie, people that you would have thought better of have got tangled up in this. But what they do is they offer investors, basically, I can sort of see the model in that most big investment hedge funds are kind of aimed at people. I mean, apologies if you are listening and you have a hedge fund. It doesn't seem likely, but you might do. For lots of hedge funds, really, sort of investors, not you, obviously, dear listener, either have more money than sense, or they think they have more sense than they do. I think that seems to be a lot of hedge fund investors. So, but if you're one of those people, like, what's his name that was involved in Terra Firma? Was it Hands? Guy Hands?
Greg Hands.
Greg Hands, that's right. Your Terra Firma man that bought EMI. People that have made lots of money from hedge funds, but are sort of that baby boomer slash sort of Generation X that still want to prove that they're cool. If you still want to be someone that isn't very generally rich, but quote unquote cool, these are the sort of people that paid hundreds of pounds to see the Rolling Stones not be very good at Glastonbury. But anyway, these sort of people, you, instead of investing your money in, I don't know, boring old arms factories, you can invest your money in, or wouldn't it be cool if you bought shares in a firm that owns music and owns back catalogue? So it's aimed at that. The whole thing was always a bit of a house on cards anyway. I don't know how it's been valued at 1.1 billion. It's almost like no one's learned anything from this. I don't understand how you can end up with a story where someone's assets are worth 25% less than they thought they were, and they still get bought for £1 billion by a rival. I think I'm starting to lose bits of my frontal lobe to this. There are plans to delist them from the stock market, which lots of people are very worried about, apparently. I'm not very sure why, but anyway. Turns out our friend Merck Mercuriadis used to manage Elton John, Iron Maiden, Guns N' Roses and Beyonce. They thought that back catalogues were undervalued in the streaming era. I don't know if that has turned out to be the case or not. Who knows what will happen, said he, but I really don't feel that it was worth £1 billion. Who knows what's going to happen? They'd already had to be forced to sell about 20,000 unspecified non-core songs for £23.1 million in December. How upset would you be, Sir T, if you were someone that song was decided to be non-core? I'm trying to see if I can find a list of what the non-core songs were. I suppose they didn't really want to publicise those, did they? But you'd be upset, wouldn't you, if your song was a non-core song?
No, absolutely. You were right, by the way. It's Guy Hans. Greg Hans, I was getting... He's a Conservative minister.
Yes, he's Hammersmith, I think, or something.
Yes, you were right with Guy Hans, so I apologise about that. No, it always seemed a bit Emperor's New Clothes-ish. Anyway, it's a little bit Jack and the Beanstalk. And I just think this may all end up in the unusual in situation where you get both buyer and seller remorse. You know, nobody...
Yeah, quite. So, no one's done well out of this, have they, really? And not even Beyonce, probably.
No. But on the other hand, wait, because here comes singer-songwriter-producer James Blake with a solution. Blake feels that companies like Spotify pay too low a payout and that artists find it difficult to support a professional lifestyle. I mean, we've discussed this before and it may be recalled. I don't see it that way. But... I feel some musicians' expectations are too high. However, James Blake is proposing a system. This is a new idea he's come up with and publicised it this week. New system called Vault, where musicians share unreleased tracks for $5 a month. So there you are, Jules. Has James Blake solved the music business crisis?
Well, some people think they might have done, and I found it quite interesting, although... I suppose the idea is that it's quite clever in the sense that the unreleased music means that it has a kind of a fresh spin on it, doesn't it, really? So you're not paying Spotify to listen to the same albums you've always listened to. You are at least getting, I suppose, new content. However, another singer-songwriter who I think called Tom Veck, who I used to listen to a lot at university in the sort of mid-2000s, who I think first started releasing records at a fairly similar-ish time to James Blake, actually, when James Blake first started out. The headline for his article in The Guardian, which I admit that he didn't write, but the headline that's been given to the article, James Blake's music subscription model is a fantasy that disadvantaged fans and musicians. And the byline says, with unrealistic costs, the inability to share music and the pressure of consumer expectations, the producer's collaboration with Vault doesn't add up. I can see it as an idea. However, it's a little bit like it's got a chat section where everyone can discuss as well. It's if you multiply the artists, the number of artists you really care about by the subscription fees, the costing, you have to pay a subscription per artist, Setti. You don't pay a subscription for the whole platform. So, of course, if there are 10 artists that you want to hear from, it instantly becomes prohibitive compared to Spotify. Yes. And then the virtue of hearing unreleased music then becomes a bit of a curse, doesn't it? What you mean, I'm not even going to hear any of the music of the bands I really like? You're essentially taking a massive risk. Although you could argue that in the olden analog days, you used to do that when you bought the new vinyl LP of a band that you really liked. There was no way of streaming it beforehand, was it? There was no way of trying trying whether or not you, unless of course you could listen in the shop, but that aside, there wasn't a way of doing it. I rather like this this thing. It says, once listeners are locked in, there is a level of guilt associated with cancelling. The general subscription model is described as a dark pattern that makes emotional hostages of fans who want to break through the monthly commitment. And that's quite an interesting point, in that if you are signing up to this, it's quite niche, isn't it? And you're signing up to this because you are a fan, I suppose. If you're paying for a subscription to an artist, you're investing in that particular artist because you want to hear from that artist. It's not like you pay a Spotify, you pay a Spotify fee and you go, oh yeah, I'd like to, you know, I'm going to listen to this person today, I'm going to listen to that person tomorrow. And, you know, you're just generally investing in music. Here, you know, if there's only 25 of you that are subscribed to a certain artist, can't really disappear. It's not like, you know, it's like not being able to leave a party that aren't many, that doesn't have many people there. You can't really sneak out very easily, can you? It's a tricky one. And I find it interesting as well, is that he says that they have when musicians move to subscription models, they have a certain obligation to create content that has already been paid for. He said, my music doesn't exist because it was paid for, and even if no one ever paid me, I'd still try to make it as much as I could. Motivation to create is no bad thing, but the pressure to meet deadlines and consumer expectations is often creatively counterproductive, which is quite interesting, really, I think. This idea that, that you know, you end up having to, you think, oh my god, I've got to release new music to my fans next week, and music that's never been released before, so that's therefore got to be new. So you either end up with music that's created under pressure, which sometimes is good and very often is not, or I can foresee a situation where you end up with the eighth different remix of the same song.
Well, absolutely. I'm no disrespect meant to James Bogart. I think it's an absolutely bonkers proposal, because I really pick up on the point you make, that if you really do like, you know, 10 artists or groups that you would normally buy their album or stream it, as you say, several times, now you would have to pay each of them $5 a month to hear that music. So $50 for 10 artists, or, you know, $100 for a month for 20 artists, when you pay $10 or $11 for the entire musical universe on Spotify.
Quite.
It'll never work. And all that would happen is that the richest and most successful musicians, they'll get even richer, and struggling artists to struggle even more. I mean, there is no ready solution, I feel, because without being patronizing to Mr. Blake, we live in an unequal world where money goes to money, and musicians are part of that world. So I would say, nice try, James Blake, but a non-runner.
Yes, I admire the sentiment of it, but I think it could be the hand that feeds you could bite you, I think, on that.
We have more. We have speech fasting. And unconnected to that, I should stress, hooray for James Blunt.
Other James Blunt are available.
Yes. Yes, that's next after Monkey House.
Go down to the river, look out to the sea one last time. Leave town like you never believed that this is where you would shine. New York owes you nothing. The city's free and clear. She gave the fear. She was always
friend, God knows you spent a lifetime here. Say tomorrow may be rainy, best be on that plane. Trains go to sleep. Stop cold in the lamplight downtown. Time to sail, time to leave. New York owes you nothing. The city's free.
I absolutely adore that. Unashamedly influenced by all things Steely Dan. Their half dozen albums or compilations are well worth exploring. Highly recommended if you love Steely Dan in particular. This is from their most recent album, Remember the Audio, Monkey House and New York Owes You Nothing.
Well, were I still doing Smooth Sailing, were the yacht not in dock, I would play that pretty regularly. I very much like that. That is lovely.
It is. It's only in the last few years that someone said something to me that I had kind of suspected for a while, and that is that I'm almost certainly, self-diagnosed, I agree, on a rather upward slope of an autism profile. I fit in with so many of the traits. I don't like change. I see and hear, smell things differently to other people. I line up objects. I count things. I repeat behaviours, and so on and so on. One thing I relish, and this may come as a surprise when you consider I've participated in over 600 podcasts and film, radio and TV. One thing
yes,
I
you're
love,
always in that media, Sir T. We can never get away from you.
Always talking. One thing I love is not having to communicate verbally, another autism thing. Because when I lived alone for a while, I would absolutely adore going several days on my own without using my voice.
Wow.
And it would be a shock after a few days hearing my voice at, I don't know, a supermarket checkout or whatever.
Yeah.
So, Jules, I was particularly interested when you brought a new concept to my attention, speech fasting, Jules.
Indeed. This is from The Guardian's, I think, a rather underrated, excellent little column called Path Notes that they produce every day, which is always done in a sort of a profile format where one person appears to be talking to another, and it always makes me laugh, Sir T. So I will try and read this to you. The person says, well, fine, I'll talk, but only under extreme duress. Why under extreme duress? I'm trying to speech fast because I want to be like Lulu, to which the questioner replies, I knew it. It's always bloody Lulu with you. Yes, but listen, whenever Lulu has a show, she doesn't talk until noon. She exists in a state of extended silence. She isn't even allowed to whisper. Doesn't that sound great? Lulu being silent, anyone being silent. Lulu says it helps her take good care of my instrument. It allows me to sing. But you don't sing. I know. But it turns out that speech fasting has a multitude of benefits that aren't necessarily related to helping you perform shout for the billionth time. So it turns out, you say it's a new practice. It's an old practice, apparently. Hindu philosophy, Mauna, is the practice of silence. The Bhagavad Gita teaches that quieting the voice and the mind helps us acknowledge the background of stillness that is our true nature. I really need to start doing this, Sati. There was a piece in Psychology Today last year that suggested that not only does silence help us become better listeners, but it can also help us empathise with those who cannot speak, such as babies. And apparently as well, it dramatically lowers blood pressure, according to a study that was published in 2006. And in mice, it's been shown to promote brain growth. And it says, this person also says, I assume that people will like you more if you aren't constantly yammering away at them. I mean, there is that possibly. Although, interestingly, there was a study in 2022 asked people to participate 30, 40, 50, 60 and 70% in conversations. So you either talk a bit or you talk a lot. And revealed that the people thought to be most likeable were the mums that spoke the most. So the person says, so I should just go in and dominate every conversation I'm in. Only up to 70%. Talk 71% of the times and you won't make friends or influence anyone, apparently. And at the end of each one, they always say, do say and don't say. Do say. Silence is golden. Don't say anything. Yes, indeed. I mean, I'm probably someone that needs more silence in their life, I think, and more serenity in their life. I do like the idea of this, I must say. I mean, I'm someone that, as a friend that visited me for the last couple of days has put it, well, you've always been a talker, Juliet. Yes, I know. But, but you know, perhaps I do wonder if I should adopt my dad's practice of talk little, say a lot. I do remember as Sir Alex Ferguson speaking about Paul Scholes once, saying that he was one of the most compelling leaders in the Manchester United dressing room of that era, because he had very little to say to himself, result of which, when he did actually say something, everybody listened and it was usually worth listening to. So maybe some speech fasting, if we want to be a bit more like Lulu or Paul Scholes. I don't know if this is only people with red hair that do this, I'm not sure, but anyway, if you want to be more like this kind of gang, maybe the Hindus were onto something, said he.
I'm all in favour. I think silence is the ultimate comforting choice. You know how Barack Obama had all his suits in one colour when he was president, so that there was one less decision he had to make.
Einstein used to do that as well. He used to have all the same outfits so that he didn't expand any brain power on that.
I feel the same way about silence. If you don't have to participate in the chiff-chaff of everyday conversation.
Oh, that's a lovely phrase. The chit-chat of everyday life. I like that.
then you know, you have peace and tranquility. Your brain doesn't have to whir into action to respond. So I'm with Lulu. Speech fasting is the way forward.
Indeed. It does indeed not make her want to shout, apparently. So maybe that is, maybe it's don't speak so that you can do shout again.
Some unkind people on social media often post that they wish James Blunt would explore extended silences. The poor fellow, he gets singled out. I'm not sure why for opprobrium. He's often lampooned and treated as a sort of joke figure, but he remains incredibly popular. Two sold out shows at the Royal Albert Hall in the last week. Jules, he has a lovely self-deprecating sense of humour. Introducing his long-term band at the Albert Hall this week, he said, the thing is, once they've worked with me, nobody else wants to work with them. I salute James Blunt.
I do as well. So I saw James Blunt perform live in 2006, I think it was. He was touring Back to Bedlam, the first album, and I saw him at Nottingham Rock City, which is not a huge venue, considering what it seems weird, doesn't it, that now he's selling out the Royal Albert Hall for two nights. Yeah, I think Rock City was probably sold out, but he was massive at that point in time. He was, you know, You're Beautiful was huge, and you know, we'd listened to his first album a lot at university, very much enjoyed it, and Nottingham Rock City is 2,000 capacity, so I guess that was a fairly big venue, but he did really seem to go huge for ages. There was a lot of kind of antipathy towards him, as you say, partly because of a sort of a class thing as well, I think it was. He was sort of, you know, sort of unashamedly posh. But like you, I very much, James Blunt's Twitter account is a thing of great joy, because he quote tweets people ragging on him, and he's extremely self-deprecating. He was a very self-deprecating performer when we saw him perform. He also unexpectedly did a cover of Where Is My Mind by the Pixies, and it was really quite good, if I remember correctly. So yes, I like him, because he has realised, and also he's got it made, hasn't he? He's got a house in Ibiza, apparently, by all accounts, in the same area as Mike Oldfield. So he clearly hasn't done too badly for himself. He continues to make records, which sell to the sort of people who aren't cool, but do drive around and listen to Radio 2 in their car and think, oh, I like that, and then buy their records. And he's very... I admire anybody that, rather than trying to be cool, is happy just to pitch to the middle, because guess what? It turns out you can make a very good living out of that. And, you know, I like someone who... He's very funny in response to people. He's really entertaining and really self-deprecating, but not in a way that... He's clever enough, I think, to make it funny rather than to make it... If it was just him slagging himself off all the time, it wouldn't be great, really. But he has a twinkle that I very much like. And even if you don't like his music, he's a very likeable character. He was very funny on stage. He told a story about a microphone that was dropping lower and lower and lower, and he just looked ridiculous by the end of it. He didn't strike me as someone that particularly bothered what anybody thought of them. And maybe that's his appeal. Maybe that's his authenticity. It's like Chris Martin from Coldplay, another band that are much lampooned, and I think their stars rose at a similar time, I think. And they were seen as very sort of both easy listening posh blokes. Chris Martin once said that he felt that Coldplay were a true punk band because they did whatever they wanted, even though nobody liked it. And actually, I think there's something to be said about these people. They may make music that might tend towards one man's radio friendly as another man's bland, I suppose. But they might make slightly more mainstream music. But there is much to admire about them in that they just cheerfully are who they are, and I like that.
Yeah, I mean, James Blunt, 20 million albums sold. Goodness all me. Seven of them, all of them reached the top 10 in the UK album charts, which is, you know, not an insignificant thing to do. And
absolutely
he's popular
not.
All around the world. I mean, these albums sell everywhere. So hooray indeed for James Blunt.
Indeed. Keep on going, man. And he's also now Cockney rhyming slang as well. So what's not to love about that?
Thanks very much for listening this week. Good to have you along.
As always, I echo the excellent sentiments of my podcasting partner.
Amy Winehouse to play us out, Jules.
Oh, yes. Glorious Amy Winehouse. Interest in her once again sparked by the upcoming new film directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. I will definitely go and see that, I think. Very mixed reviews, to put it mildly, but I'd be interested to see it. A friend of mine saw it, enjoyed it very much. So it reminded me of how much I loved Amy Winehouse. This is from her first album, Frank, which is excellent, but was rather eclipsed by Back to Black and the Beehive era and all that sort of thing. I saw her touring this at UEA in 2004, 2005, I think, around that time. And she was brilliant. This was, I always have to say, it was pre-Beehive, but she was fantastic. And the whole first album, really interesting mix of sort of hip-hop and her influences as a young person. And she always had that kind of classic soul chops to her. And I really love this because it's got such a kind of almost Ella Fitzgerald-y sort of jazzy vibe, but it's also very much of its kind of time of the 90s and the noughties as well, which I love. It manages to be sort of retro and timeless at the same time. This is Amy Winehouse from the album Frank and Help Yourself.
When I walk in your shoes, I understand a man confused. That must have been, but I don't care. I feel the way your shoulders bend. Sorry, the empathize. Looking through your bloodshot eyes, and I know you so frustrated. Above the old become what we once had. Clever than me, so smart, but I'm not just. some drama queen. Cause it's where you're at, not where you've been. So what do you expect from me? To hold your head above the sea and carry you, even though you're bigger. Cause don't you know, you crushed my tiny figure. And anyway, we're still so young.
Yeah, I'm so young.
And this isn't yesterday. I can't help you if you won't help yourself. I can't help you. No, I can't help you if you don't help yourself. You won't help yourself. You can only get so much from someone else. If you won't help yourself, you might be 25, but in my mind I see you at 16 years old most the time. And I'm just a child, and you full grown. And no,
you've been listening to a parish council production.